Sly.
The rest of side A is the interview with Sam Bradfield.
Answer to question one, W.S. Bradfield, mechanical engineering professor. Question two, 1961, 43 years old. Question three, Convair Astronautics, Division of General Dynamics, San Diego, senior staff research scientist.
Being at what is now San Diego State University.
Hold it, let's see how that's coming through.
Dean Irvine, Thomas Francis Irvine, was totally responsible for my coming to Stony Brook. He interviewed me, came to California and interviewed me for the position at Stony Brook.
How did he hear about you?
Well, he and I were graduate students together at the University of Minnesota. Yes, we shared the same professor, thesis professor, in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Minnesota. And I had no idea that I would ever go to New York. New York was the last state on my list of priorities of places to go to work. But the reason I went there was precisely because it was a university in the making, and a chance to participate in the creation of a new university was most exciting, and that was what made up my mind at that time. It was my understanding that one of the major purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook was the creation of an engineering science-oriented College of Engineering. And that was the vision which we were going to be, instrumental in helping to transform into reality. When I first came to Stony Brook, in the first place, I didn't know Long Island was east of New York City until I made the trip there across the country in my little sports car. But when I got there, I was at the Oyster Bay campus.
Yes. Planning Fields.
Yeah.
Right.
And the then dean was he was a specialist in English literature. I'm not sure.
He was a philosopher.
He was a philosopher.
He was a philosopher from Chicago without a PhD.
Oh.
Leonard Olson.
Yeah, Leonard Olson. He was one of those who interviewed me, and I must say I was a little nonplussed. I was expecting anything, but the group of people whom we met were certainly not technically oriented, and it was I loved the campus as it was at that time, and the people were friendly. There didn't seem to be any leadership. You asked about leadership here, and it was an interesting spirit. I wouldn't say that, speaking as an engineer, I wouldn't say it was like, and having just left industry.
Yes.
It was certainly the antithesis of what I had been living with. But it didn't particularly disturb me. It was just a very interesting situation. We were merged with people from chemistry and physics very closely, and the people in the humanities, and we played tennis and ate together and argued together. And so in that case, it was a very good start. But the thing that was very troublesome immediately was, you know, if you get three people together, you've got a potential political situation.
Right.
And politics started immediately. And
what nature was the politics?
Staking out territories was the way it impressed me. The humanists in one camp, and the physicists and chemists, not quite sure which camp they were in the engineering camp or the humanities camp, and the problem with having an engineering professor as the president at that time.
This was Lee. You came in 61?
Yes, John Lee was there.
Was there then?
Yes. Because he had been Tom Irvine had been working for John Lee.
At Raleigh.
At Raleigh.
Yeah.
And so that group came up. And John, as a department chairman at Raleigh, hadn't had sufficient scope of political experience, I think. This is just my personal recollection.
Yeah.
To really prepare him for what he was getting into in trying to be the leader in bringing what is now a really big university into being. He had the spirit and he had the aims and the ideals, but he wasn't a practical politician. And he got in, as I was saying, he got into political trouble almost immediately as soon as he got on the campus.
With people on the campus or with Albany or both?
Both. Both. First with people on the campus, which I think he handled as well as anybody would have, you know. You'd get that sort of thing on any campus. If you are a department chairman, you're familiar with that. But then trying to deal with the legislature and the Board of Regents, I understand his trouble was with the Board of Regents, the one where he made his stand and wound up having to leave. But I'm not sure about that.
I think sure it was the Regents and not the trustees.
The trustees, that's
right. The
trustees? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Board of Trustees.
Yeah. And of course, you know a lot more about that than I anyway, because you're in a better position to be involved in that. But so I probably shouldn't even try. I'm just giving you my impression as a working professor,
right.
Which is what I was at that time. And so that's under question number 8 there. What events, what persons, and what experiences stand out in your mind? Oh, gosh.
What about the students, the quality of the students?
Well, they weren't especially high quality when we got there. As I remember, there were about 6 students in engineering. And they were being taught by a very pleasant young man whose name I can't remember, who later was moved into the administrative activity of the College of Engineering. But he really wasn't he didn't have a PhD in the first place. He wasn't really well prepared by experience to know what a university, to distinguish between, say, a university and a community college level of instructional activity. But he was doing the best he could with what he had.
So it wasn't Harris, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was an Irish name. Well, another Irish name. But I can't remember. Tom Irvine would know instantly. Because
where did you get your curriculum? Do you remember who drafted it initially?
Well, I believe we all had a hand in that.
I see.
All of us who were there. And
who besides you and Tom were in engineering?
Bob Sess came there right away.
I see.
But he was quite a young man at that time, and he was shy, and it took him a while to move into gear to become the real giant that he is today. So he didn't contribute as much as he would have if he had been, say, 5 years older or more experienced. Another one came was, I'll fish.
Irving Gerst?
Oh, Irving Gerst was certainly there, but I remember him with great pleasure and respect, but he contributed, of course, to the development of curriculum in applied mathematics, and he was also very much responsible for the development of the computer science activity there. He brought in our first director of
Feinerman?
Yeah, Aaron Feinerman.
Yeah.
He brought Aaron Feinerman in, and that whole activity started at that time. And we were very much, all of us were active in searching for and helping to evaluate incoming personnel. The Chang, for example.
Sheldon Chang.
Sheldon Chang was one of the early ones to come in. And of course, he did so much in helping to develop the electrical engineering curriculum. And
he was a friend. He knew back in high school, he knew Frank Yan.
Oh, is that
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
Yep. Back in China.
I would have been surprised if he had gone into physics, if Sheldon would have gotten himself a Nobel Prize. He's a very brilliant man. And let's see, who else did we have there who were instrumental at that time that we worked with at the very beginning? I can't really remember.
All right.
You might be able to remember better.
I think Tom told me that he'd gotten some ideas from some of the people at General Electric.
Yes. There was definitely, in fact, we had a report. I would call it a report. Others might call it something else. But they had been commissioned to do a study and to make recommendations on the type of curriculum which they felt the state of New York needed. In a public university, and that was very helpful to us.
Who commissioned them?
May I say the Board of Regents again? No, it was Governor Rockefeller,
was
wasn't
it? Rockefeller?
Yeah, I believe it was.
Could very well be.
Yeah. And that, I remember that, I have a picture in my mind's eye of that book, that document, with its blue cover, you know, lying on my desk, and we used it, which was no problem, because that's the way we felt about it anyway.
No.
And, of course, I'm sure that Tom and John Lee, in recruiting for the engineering college, had that in mind, picking people who would be sympathetic to that point of view. So we were struggling through that, those early phases, not struggling, we were galloping through it as a challenge at that time, the development of an engineering curriculum, which is quite different from the one which we went through as undergraduates. And
what's the difference between engineering science and the typical civil, mechanical, electrical, chemical subdivision?
Yeah.
What is the difference?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that. I can give you a reason.
A rationale.
Yeah, I'll give you a rationale for it first, based on history, and then I can tell you. Jump 30 years and say, yeah, well, this is the way it turned out. The revolution started in World War II. And I think the best example is people like myself, for example, who were trained as undergraduates at Purdue University in the traditional mechanical engineering curriculum, came out and we were thrown into the engineering science developments, that is, the types of, we were handbook engineers. Mm-hmm. Purdue has a fine reputation as a university, and so what it was teaching as engineering was typical of what the country was teaching. And we were taught to design things and build things, and we went to handbooks to get our information. Well, the kind of stuff that was being developed and thrown at us, and we were throwing at other people during World War II, there were no handbooks.
Yeah.
And most of us didn't have sufficient training in basic physics and mathematics to be able to write the theories and sort of do the groundwork preliminary to developing the handbooks for the designs that we had to do. For example, I got into supersonic aerodynamics right away, and there were no supersonic wind tunnels in this country at that time. I'd never seen one, and neither had the guys that I was working with designing this equipment. It made it harder to find a handbook to go to. And so we wound up working for physicists and mathematicians. And we hated it because we had always sort of looked down our noses as engineers at these theoreticians that they didn't know how to do anything type of thing, you know. And they were directing our work. Well, there was a real impetus for, we recognized our shortcomings, and there was a real impetus for us to make the changes in the undergraduate and graduate curricula, which would permit engineers to have a greater hand in their own destiny, so to speak. And that was
be capable of the research that you needed to conduct in order to bring into being new types of hardware.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right across from it. Now, for example, today, yesterday, our visitor is talking about the metal matrix composites, materials that didn't exist at all in those days.
Right, of course.
And these metal matrix composites, and that's what we're doing in my little experimental boat building business. We're developing methods of manufacture with composite materials. all new to me,
you know.
Yeah. And you don't have a handbook on that stuff today, yeah. Even. The handbooks don't exist today, but now we're able to do our own theory. Jim Gorey from Clemson is a theoretician in composites fatigue. But he's a mechanical engineer. He's not a physicist. That's the sort of stuff that no engineer would have been doing in that time. So we went at Stony Brook. We sort of passed to the limit, and it happened all over the country. People got rid of the old machine shops, the foundries, the drafting, all of the stuff that was practical. And they started moving in applied mathematics, applied physics, and all of the, and computer science, and all of the stuff that we hadn't had before. You know how we went to...
Pendulum swung pretty far.
Exactly so, yes. Yeah. And that's the way we started. And by the time I left, in fact, 10 years before I left, which was in 83, yeah, by the early 70s, we began to see that we had gone too far. And we tried to, we had even been avoiding calling ourselves mechanical engineers. We were thermal scientists or whatever. And we didn't know what to call ourselves for a long time. And it wasn't until in that department, until the 70s, that we recognized, at that time I guess I was department chairman, we recognized that industry really didn't know, they couldn't relate very well to the product that we were turning out.
Yeah.
If you don't call it a mechanical engineer, then it's not a mechanical engineer, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's when we swung back and came back to the mechanical engineering name in our department. I guess we were one of the last to get the message. But at present time, then and down here, we are having, they're sorting out, USF started, the University of South Florida, started about the same time Stony Brook. They haven't progressed nearly as far, in my humble opinion. But there now, I became a part of a joint mechanical-chemical department. Well, now we're splitting. Right now, we're making the split. So in engineering, things are just now, I think, for the new universities are beginning to come back to the old traditional way, but the curriculum has changed. And there is a lot more, I think, capability of today's undergraduate engineer, having graduate undergraduate engineer, to do innovative and creative work and to initiate research than when we left. At least that's my opinion. Let's see, what was my understanding of my own place in the future, and why do I think I was appointed? Well, they need an experimentalist, and they needed somebody to develop laboratories for both undergraduate instruction. And I had that experience and confidence in my ability to do that, and also to do it in a way which was not the old cookbook way of laboratories, but to develop, my challenge was to develop laboratories that would require innovation and the application of creative ability. And so that's why I was brought there, and that's what I did. I didn't have any expectations when I got there. I mean, I didn't want to go to a place where everything was laid out. I was typical, I think. I didn't want to go to a place where everything was laid out for me.
Yeah.
I wanted to go into a place and start
creating
things.
Yeah.
And I think that was typical of the group of people who were assembled there. We enjoyed that stuff. How have these expectations worked out personally and for the institution? I have to say that probably it made about as much difference in the future of the institution as one drop of water in a placid puddle, if any. I think things would have worked out regardless of
whether you were there or not.
Yeah, probably. I don't.
What do you think your own personal contributions were? You say you were department chairman?
Yes, I was. In a sense, I had a, naturally, I had a big say in recruiting.
That's important.
Well, it is, I guess, when you stop to think about it, and one stops to think about it. And the kinds of people whom I recruited were naturally people who had the same goals and who had the same type of training and background that I had, which...
Can you mention one or two of them?
Well, Ted O'Brien was one, and he came in turbulence. He was a... and he turned out that he's internationally recognized as a person in turbulence. René Chevrier came in also in the field of fluid mechanics, and he has turned out to be a very well-recognized person, although he wound up at Columbia University, but he likes the city. He came from Paris, and so he likes New York. And there was, in the field of combustion, there was Abe Burlap, whom I recruited, and people like that in the department. my activities were pretty much, I would say, my activities were pretty much confined to the Stony Brook campus. So far as the development of the university is concerned, I never did get involved with things outside the campus very much. By 1971, at Stony Brook, I believe that we had had the department pretty well set up and operating. as it is today. So that whatever it is today, we had pretty well accomplished by 1971, I think. And then it was a matter of maturing and getting research out and getting recognition and refining the curriculum and getting the graduate program pinned down. All the curriculum always changes, as I guess we all know, and never stays the same.
You have a hand in the construction of the other of the buildings other than the original?
Yeah.
What?
I would say that in the planning, yes.
Yes, in the planning stage?
Yeah.
Let's see.
In the heavy engineering, we started off in the humanities building. We moved from Oyster Bay to the humanities building.
Is that right?
Yeah. And then we moved from the humanities building to the chemistry building. As the buildings went up, we moved closer to engineering. And then the engineering buildings were the third flight to be finished, and we moved from the chemistry building into
the
light engineering.
Light engineering, the red brick, the long red brick building.
That's right. And then finally we moved from the administrative building for engineering, or was. I suppose it's still, that's where the dean's office is. Then there are light engineering laboratories were built, the little brown building right across from the red brick building there. And then the big brown brick building, which was, and the computer center, went up above that. Now, I had a hand in the planning of all of those engineering buildings except the computer science building. And that was a real drain.
Yeah, it took a lot of time.
Yeah. I can see it going on here now among the younger faculty.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things that you have to do in addition to everything else that has to be done. I'm not sure in the first place that it's very rewarding. In the second place, I'm not sure that you ever do it right.
You have to look ahead, and maybe your vision isn't too clear as to what's coming.
Exactly so, because you in a place like Stony Brook, for example, you don't have your faculty yet.
Yeah.
You know from your experience as an academician that buildings should be designed for specific areas of activity, academic activity, and that includes the laboratories for research, particularly in the physical sciences, including engineering. And we would have all this money dumped on us and would have to spend it by a particular time, and we really didn't know what was going to be used for. So there were some mistakes made.
In those days, money was available.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Money was available. People were harder to find. And it was just sort of like walking through the fog in a vaguely familiar landscape and hoping you didn't step in a really big hole. That's the way I found. Besides, you didn't want to do it anyway. it was aggravating. But I guess we didn't do any worse than anybody else, many of the other engineering groups trying. We tried to do the best we could do, and that's all you can do. We tried to stay with basic instrumentation and try to purchase things that could be used or would be used by as broad a spectrum of engineering specialists as possible, like instrumentation and things like that. And then in the early 60s, the electron tube was replaced by solid-state electronics. Just as we got our laboratories, I was responsible for the instrumentation laboratories before Sheldon Chang came in. And we had, I had purchased some instrumentation which the University of Illinois had been using for instructional purposes, which I thought was very good. I went there and took a short course just to check it out in the summertime. And it had some solid-state electronics and still had a fair number of vacuum tubes involved in it. And then by the next year, Sheldon came in and we talked about the instrumentation laboratory, and he said, no, he says, that electron tube stuff is no good, it's got to go. And so it did. He was right, of course.
Yeah.
He was the expert. So we were working, a lot of us were working in that, in these areas where we were only fringe area experts, you know, because there was nobody else there. Yeah. Well, anyway, it was fun. So Sheldon was naming individuals who did things that were important for the future development of the university as a whole. He was certainly a significant influence in that area. Aaron Feinerman was a very strong influence in the planning and development.
I remember him coming to me and saying, you know anything about computers? And I said, not a thing. And he
most
said,
of us.
And he said, well, you really ought to go up to the school at IBM. Well, it wasn't a school, it was an invitation to the heads of colleges and universities,
mm-hmm.
to get a small smattering, a kind of a seminar,
mm-hmm.
for administrators, which I did. I went up to Binghamton, and then later on to their offices at the Poughkeepsie.
Uh-huh.
And,
did you find it was very helpful?
Yes, mm-hmm. I backed it. They were just starting the 360. Series,
uh-huh.
of hardware. So I backed Feinerman to the best of my ability.
Well, that was a terrific thing because as a result of that effort, we got off to a flying start in that area.
Yeah.
And I thought that was terrific. We were all proud of that. Speaking of things you remember, I'll never forget the time in the 60s when the students were breaking the windows in the computer center and there was riots. We were up all night on 20, we had 24 four-hour duty guarding the engineering building. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
Yeah.
The late 60s, that John Toll was president.
Yeah.
And I was living off campus. I remember there were problems, certainly.
Yeah, that was shocking to me. I suppose that's why I remember it. It just seemed so needless, and so senseless. To do something like that. I lost my respect for young people a lot. I don't, not all of it, but I lost some respect for young people as a result of those goings on. But nevertheless, that's those are some of the things that I remember.
Okay. I think, do you remember when Harry Porter brought me down to Planting Fields, and there was, my first introduction was to a group of people sitting around a long table in the room off to one side in the Great Hall. I don't know whether you remember that or not. I think you were one of those there.
Yeah, I remember that. That was the table at which we had a lot of our committee meetings.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you know anything about me before I was introduced to you?
I don't think I did. I don't remember that I did, but you know, I'm not a very good person as an academician in many ways, because I'm pretty much too much focused in my interests.
Yeah.
Unlike physicists or chemists, like Francis Bonner, for example, great musician, politically active, well, he would know all about you, I imagine. And Tom Irvine would too, probably. But I didn't know.
Well, I just wondered whether I was simply imposed on you people by the central office, mm-hmm. whether you'd had any voice in my selection to begin with.
Did you ask Tom that question?
I haven't.
Yeah, you ought to, because he would know, and I wouldn't.
Yeah, all right. I know Sajishi was there.
Yeah, Sajishi.
And Pond was there.
Yeah, Alec Pond. Well, we were, I don't know,